City Council study meeting for the City of South Jordan. Today is Tuesday, January 3rd, 2023. That's kind of hard to believe and kind of hard to say. Welcome. My name is Dawn Ramsey, and as mayor of the city, I am joining you electronically tonight, making our way home from the weekend and encountered some adverse weather that only allowed us to get halfway home. So joining electronically tonight, and we'll finish the rest of the trip home tomorrow. We have all the rest of the council there in person, with the exception of Mrs. Zander, who will be there momentarily. Hi, everyone. I hope you all had a good, happy new year. Thank you for being there. And to all of our administrative staff, our department heads, and our city management, thank you so much for being there as well. We're going to open tonight's meeting with an invocation by our Director of Strategy and Budget, Mr. Don Tingey.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we thank thee for this day and grateful that we could meet together tonight in this council meeting work study meeting. Thankful for our opportunity to serve this great community, and bless that as we do so, that we, thy spirit might be here and that we might make good decisions tonight. I'm grateful for those that serve in the community, especially this weekend as we've had a lot of snow, and thankful for those that have worked to keep our community safe. And again, we bless this community that we serve, and we say these things in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Mr. Tingey. Appreciate that. Welcome to any public. Apologies that I can't see who's there, but I can see the council and some of our staff. But if we have any members of the public there in person, and I know we have a few online, welcome to each of you as well. We appreciate you joining us this evening. I'm going to ask for a motion to amend the agenda just to include the words electronic meeting. We've been doing electronic meetings for more than 3 years now. But since I'm joining this meeting electronically this way, I'd like to ask if I can get a motion from someone on the council to amend the agenda just to include the words electronic meeting.
So moved, Mayor. Electronic meeting. Let's add that to the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Marler. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there any opposed? Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, item C, mayor and council coordination. Does anybody have anything you'd like to bring up? Any of the board you're serving on, any information to bring back to us that we need to be aware of? I'm not seeing any. Okay, if there's not, we will move forward, because most of what I would have to bring up we're going to discuss is kind of a legislative update later tonight anyway. So I think we're good. If there isn't anything, we'll move on. Okay, item D, we have a discussion and review of our regular council meeting. It's a fairly straightforward agenda. First, we'll have the resolution proclaiming January 16th, 2023 as Religious Freedom Day. And that is something that we've done in the past. And then we've got some annexation items. They're listed there on their agenda, on your agenda in front of you. Does anyone have any questions specifically about either one of those? Anybody have any questions in this meeting that you want to ask Ryan or Gary, Dustin, anybody? No? Okay. Seeing none, let's move on to item E. We've got some discussion items. I'm looking forward to this presentation. Aaron Sainsbury is with us, our Risk and Emergency Safety Manager for the City of South Jordan. Aaron's going to give us a presentation. We'll have a discussion of our updated Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan. This is a briefing I appreciate, and one that I think is good for all of us to hear. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Aaron.
Thanks, Mayor. First off, I'd like to quickly, introduce myself. My name is Aaron Sainsbury. I've been with the city since 1998, so I've been here for quite a while. I've seen the city grow a little bit in my time. I absolutely love not only the city, but those that I work with. And I want to thank Gary for the opportunity to get up here and present not only on our comprehensive emergency management plan, but some of the things that we're doing in emergency management. First off, I'm going to start off with, oh, it's not working. There we go. I'm going to start off with a question that Gary asked me. Gary asked, are we ready in emergency management? That's kind of a loaded question. I don't know how you answer that. I'll give you the probably a legal definition. Hopefully I can use it, Ryan, but it depends. I think it depends on a lot of things. It depends on the hazards, the risks, some of the things that we're preparing for, the unknowns. You know, what's going to happen? When is it going to happen? Things like that. I remember 27 years ago when I had my first child, people would ask me all the time, are you ready? Well, I don't know if anybody's ever ready, right? I feel the same way about emergency management and about emergency preparedness. I don't know if we're ever ready. But what I do want to share is what is our comfort level. Our comfort level, it depends on what we have doing or what we have going in the city, who we have working here, you know, who are our mentors, who is providing information, giving us advice. I'll tell you that my predecessor, Dustin Lewis, is a pioneer to emergency management. He's been doing it a long time. He was a great mentor for me at the time when I first started emergency management. When I say he's a pioneer, there's a lot of people that he worked with in emergency management that are no longer in emergency management. And we joke and laugh about it, but one, they're either retired or, I hate to say it, Dustin, but a lot of them have passed away.
How old are you?
So as far as our comfort level...
Years as in 1847?
I've been around a lot longer than you think.
I've got a great, great mentor now. Chief Dawson is who I work for now under the fire department. Great mentor. He understands emergency management really well. And it's nice to be on that team and to work close with the fire department. But as far as our comfort level, again, I'm going to go back to the different departments. When we have a catastrophic event or disaster, they're not going to do anything different than they do on a daily basis. So do we have a staff that can go out and they understand what goes on in the field, whether it's the police department or the fire department or public works? Absolutely they do. And so my comfort level with you know, a larger scale, and if we do have a catastrophic event, is high. A great comfort level because of the staff that we have and what we have here in South Jordan. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of highlight our current program, what we're doing, some of the mitigation efforts, and then talk a little bit about community education and outreach. So to begin, I'm going to read a quick story. This happened in Baltimore, February 7th, 1904. Baltimore residents awoke February 7th, 1904, to clear skies, mild temperatures around 10 a.m. A cold front began to move in, bringing with it increasingly gusty winds. Then at 10:45, the alarm sounded. Over the next 30 hours, the Great Baltimore Fire raged, fanned by sustained winds between 10 knots and 20 knots, with gusts 36 knots. The fire consumed 1,500 buildings, 2,500 businesses spread over 70 city blocks. Amazingly, only one life was lost, and that was a firefighter, James McLennan. Within a few hours of the initial call, dedicated firefighters and their equipment began to arrive by rail from places as far away as Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York. Soon there were 1,231 firefighters, 57 engines, 9 trucks, 2 hose companies, 1 fire boat, 1 police boat, and all ready to battle the blaze. Tragically, many of the firefighters who had mobilized and traveled great distances were forced to stand idly by and watch as the blaze ravaged the city. Their efforts and equipment proved useless because the couplings on the fire hoses were incompatible with Baltimore's fire hydrants. So what did we learn from that tragedy? Right now, if you were to, the water department puts them in, the engineering department requires different fire hydrants in the city, but now they're national standard thread. So every fire department is able to hook to the fire hydrants no matter who shows up. I'm going to talk a little bit about that here. Has everybody heard of NIMS and ICS? So in South Georgia, in 2005, 2006, as Dustin was the emergency manager, there was a requirement that the city has every staff member in South Jordan get their NIMS compliance for ICS 100, 200, 700, and 800. And what that is basically, it's the primary standard of how the federal government operates in a catastrophic event or an emergency. I'm going to talk about the origination of ICS real quick, and then talk about NIMS as well. So ICS stands for Incident Command System. Let me go to that. Incident Command System, and it began in 1970. There's an interagency group of Southern California called FireScope, originated to ICS. And what had happened is multiple fires burning at the same time, taxing the resources. So we're only as good as the resources we have, right? And if we need additional resources, we have to call those in. If they come in and they can't connect to our fire hydrants, or they don't speak the same language, just like what happened in 1904, then there's going to be problems. So they tax resources, creating dangerous wildfire urban interface. Over 13 days, 16 deaths, 700 structures destroyed, 500 acres burned, and it was $234 million. And again, that's in 1970. So they did what's called an after-action review. And the after-action review, they found, the communication's huge, right? Anytime we do either a planned event or we have a disaster, an emergency or a disaster within the valley or within the state, communication is always on that after-action plan. During that after-action review, there was confusion derived from differing terminology, coordination to handle competing resources, demands, and resource priorities were inadequate. So those are some of the things that they learned during that. And they changed this fire scope, changed the way they operate. They operate under an ICS structure now. So everybody's speaking the same language. Everybody's hooking or able to hook to fire hydrants. Everybody's able to operate seamlessly. So in 1980, the nation basically adopted ICS. And so everybody that's working on wildfires is speaking the same language, and that's what we want. Then what happens in September 11, 2001? We all know what happens. President Bush issued a Homeland Security Presidential Directive 5, it's basically directing development of a single national incident management system, all risks, all hazards. So now instead of talking about the wildfires, urban wildland interface, we're talking about all hazards and all risks. So we're speaking the same language and doing the exact same thing that FireScope started in the 70s. So we turn our attention to what's required and what FEMA has asked of us and what we need to have in place in order to communicate, in order to have continuity of government, in order to speak the same common terminology, speak the same language with everybody else. We're supposed to have a hazard mitigation plan. We're supposed to have an IPP, which is an integrated preparedness plan, which is the same if you turn back time a few years ago, it was called a training and exercise plan. So the IPP, and we also have to have, which we have those two documents, but we also have to have the comprehensive emergency management plan. And I'll talk about what's in this guide, but it has been sent out to leadership. So in order for us to get federal funding, whether it's disaster relief funds, or whether it's our EMPG, we get $28,000 a year for emergency management performance grant funds. In order to get that, we've got to have these documents in place. And basically what it's doing is it's basically aligning us with everybody else in the country and what's going on and speaking the same language, just like the fire hydrants. We need to be able to connect to them. So what's in the SEMP? The SEMP has the hazard analysis and risk assessment. So what we've done is we've gone through and looked at all of our risks and all of our hazards in the city and put them on a map and identified what areas of concern. All of that is in this SEMP. Our response and operation framework is basically the initial emergency response and operational roles. Part three is the post-disaster recovery. So it's procedures to coordinate recovery and continuity of operations. So back, when the pandemic started, everybody was in the office. Everybody was working. This also, has it also outlines the flexibility that we would have. The city did a good job. Gary was able to, pull his leadership group together. We were able to get people working online, get people to continue to work. And that's part of the continuity of operations, which, like I said, is in the SEMP. Part four is the potential project identification. And then part five is the preparedness plan, which is the training and exercise plan. So all those things are, all those parts are in that as well. And then there's what's called the ESFs, or the emergency support functions. Each one of those support functions, what they are is it's a structure for coordinating interagency support. So if we do have to call people in, whether it's feds or neighboring jurisdictions or the county or whoever it is, they come in. This is that structure that helps identify the interagency support. And last but not least, there's support annexes in the plan as well. And what the support annexes are is the first one is water utility plan, which I saw Jason Rasmussen here. His team put together the water utility plan. How are the water folks going to operate? What are they going to do? How are they going to mitigate or eliminate any kind of issues that they see in the field? It's basically their emergency operations plan. A debris management plan is the support annex 2. The support annex 3 is evacuation plan, and then the neighborhood network plan. And what the neighborhood network plan is, I'll talk a little bit about Safe Neighborhoods program, and also about the 501c3s that we work with, or the BOADs. I'll talk a little bit about those as well. So what are the hazards in South Jordan? What are the risks and hazards that we plan and prepare for? When I say all risks, all hazards, what are we planning and preparing for? We've kind of broke them up into two categories. There's natural hazards, which is flood, geological hazards, which would include earthquake, ground shaking, liquefaction, and other things. Wildfire, drought, pandemics, epidemics. When I used to go out and present prior to COVID, I'd go out and we'd talk a little bit about epidemics and pandemics, and there wasn't a single soul that could tell me what it was. Everybody knows now. Severe storm, winter storm, thunderstorm, tornadoes, high winds, and then human caused or technological is the other category. So hazardous materials, power outages, fallen aircraft. We don't think of that as being a hazard, but there's two main airports airports in Salt Lake County. Terrorism, civil disturbance, dam failure, agricultural, and what's becoming extremely popular is, John and Phil knows, cyber attacks. I mean, they're blocking tons and tons every single day. So if we were to put those hazards all on a matrix, what does it look like? So if I look at the hazard, the severity compared to the probability, whether it's low, moderate, or high, it kind of tells us, which areas are we going to have the biggest problem in, right? So you hear about earthquakes quite a bit, and there's a reason why you hear about earthquakes quite a bit, because it's a high probability, and when it does happen, it's going to be severe, and we know that. So if I were to look at even though that's what we're planning and preparing for, and we are looking at the all hazards, we know
We know where some of the, if we were to look at this disaster history, we know from the history what the most potential cause for disaster would be if it's a federally declared disaster. That's really hard to read, but I'm going to try to go through it really quick. 2020 events, I do want to hit on that really quick because there was so much going on. Obviously, the COVID pandemic. These were things that actually affected our city and that hit our city, whether we were looking at it from an intelligence standpoint or we were just getting information. But the earthquake, obviously, we were getting phone calls on the earthquake. Protests, you guys remember the May 26, 2020 protests. Civil unrest, what happened down in Salt Lake. We sent a few of our officers down there. It got pretty ugly, if I remember right. Windstorms, believe it or not, we sent our public works folks out to help with the windstorms in Salt Lake to help with debris management. We actually were able to take our debris management plan that I have included in this SEMP and work off of that, and we were able to update some of the information in that plan. Wildfires, there was quite a few wildfires. As you can see, 78% of wildfires that happened that year were human caused, and it's usually around 80 to 90%. Explosive material at a residence. I didn't know what that was when I was told that there was TATP at a resident's house over on Snow Moon. However, when I looked it up, we call it...
Mother of Satan.
That's right. But in the emergency management world, anything bad, we call it methyl ethyl death or methyl ethyl kilomol. So all I knew was by that name, you know, something bad, right? And so I looked it up, and that's exactly what it said. Also known as Mother of Satan, and I thought, it's bad. So it was ugly. Presidential election year, even though that doesn't affect us here, we're still looking at it from an intelligence standpoint because we're getting threats that voting sites are going to be, we're threatened. Voting sites, we're going to have protesters, we're going to have other things. And then EMAC deployment requests. EMAC deployment it stands for Emergency Management Assistance Compacts. Anytime a neighboring state or any state in the nation needs assistance, they'll send in an EMAC request, which goes from their state to our state, and then they send it out asking for help. And we're part of that EMAC deployment.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
If you go back that slide, on several of these, we deployed South Jordan personnel and devices to go help another city, neighboring city. Obviously, if it happened here, we'd ask for help to come back. In those situations, if we're sending people to help other cities at a regular basis, that's our tax dollars helping support another city. I'm curious, is there any reciprocation on those things, or we just do that in a nice goodwill situation?
We actually have written agreements, mutual aid agreements, and those are good for the first few hours of those emergencies. If they go into multiple phases, then there's ways for us to recoup those costs back from those agencies so that we don't go send our people for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. But for sending Mike to Salt Lake to help with the riots, then they come here to help us on our next issue.
Okay, so the riots was a matter of a few hours, but mm-hmm. it seems like one of our vehicles was damaged.
Mm-hmm. And those other jurisdictions pay for it. We recently had one of our vehicles damaged, and that jurisdiction is going to cover the damage to it.
Good.
We had an entity here when we had the house with the methyl kilomol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Their vehicle got damaged. We paid for it.
Who's
West Valley?
West Valley. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
yeah, we have agreements that work all.
Even though inside the agreements that we use on those short term basis says we won't charge each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says.
Mm-hmm.
We have over time. If they're large enough expenses, we've helped cover damages.
Is there a dollar amount that's specified in those agreements? So
it actually says we'll take care of our own damages.
Okay.
Yeah, the liability, the risk, all of that is we take care of ours. We take care of theirs.
I think that generally,
because we all know that we're going to be generally sending a lot more help to Salt Lake than they'll send to us.
It's kind of a two-way street.
Yeah.
I mean, they just have more problems than we do because of the population.
Well, but they also have resources that we don't always have.
True.
That we call on them for.
Okay.
So it's a pretty good two-way street.
Okay, but there is a reciprocal, like we get reimbursed for things that are...
And I don't think, in all the years I've been here, I don't, even when I was in the fire department, there wasn't a reciprocity issue where someone was really taking advantage of another.
Right.
Because nobody likes to have these things anyway happen, right?
Right.
Because they cost us all money. But everybody's been super great to work with, really, quite frankly.
And it would cost us a lot more to have those resources.
Oh, 100%.
Than
sharing is
it
good.
Would cost
yeah.
us to use them from time to time.
Right.
Well, the explosion house is a good example. That was a very expensive, and we had aid from multiple jurisdictions, departments, even the federal government helping us on that,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't bill us for it.
Well, and some of those employees of other jurisdictions were on site for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And here's my follow-up to that, and I think I've heard you answer this before. In the event that we have this explosive home in South Jordan, and we have 4 cities responding, who is the final judgment call? Like, does
the
it
jurisdiction in charge.
Yeah, it
okay.
goes back to the incident command system. That's why we have that.
Okay.
Incident command.
So when we're downtown responding to the May 26th protests, the mayor of that town has
yeah.
the final
we plug
word.
Into their incident command
well,
system.
It's really the on-scene incident commander who's really in charge of the incident who we really report to.
With the caveat, if we don't like what's going on, there's no obligation. We have to keep our people there. We think there's something that is inherently wrong or unsafe that we don't agree with. We can pull.
Yeah.
Okay.
All those agreements
I like
have now that if we can't send resources or we don't agree
okay.
with it, we don't have to send resources.
Okay. I like it. Okay. Those are great answers. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And
thank
Councilmember Zander, I'm glad you stopped. I actually took this picture here. And if you were to look close, it says landscaping project brought to you by 2020.
It's hilarious.
Which even in a, you know, it's nice to see people still have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell her that we saved that tree in the park strip. But
oh, my reputation for safety.
But one thing I will say, Cameron, because I think there's a real difference here. One is, I think what Aaron's talking about are longer-term incidents that last longer than a day or even
yeah.
a few
yeah.
hours.
Yeah.
I would say every day we use resources outside of our city.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know.
And we
okay.
do the same
okay.
going back to other cities. And this happens regularly with our neighbors. So I would say all our surrounding neighbors, this happens too on a regular basis, both police, fire, and at times public works.
For the most part, you don't nickel and dime each other.
No.
You just kind of, you know, unless there's something big, you just, you
it
know,
comes
you take,
out in the wash.
It comes out in the wash.
It all works out in the end.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know,
and
Chiefs,
really...
if you want to add to that, but you guys see it every day.
I mean, that is the case. We actually, our agreements on fireside are any incident after we hit the 24-hour mark, we typically will charge for it. It's a significant incident. Otherwise, we do every single day operate mutual aid. We go out and have units coming into the city. That's accurate every day.
One of the things I've noticed in my 7 years in my seat is that there's a very good harmonious reciprocation kind of feeling between the cities. And that's not always the case politically, but I love that our emergency responders have that harmonious relationships. I just wanted to say that. I've noticed that, and I love and respect that.
Even I don't even remember if you remember, but... It might have been 3 to 4 years ago when Sandy's Public Works yard burned down. Their shop.
They lost all their snow.
They lost all their snow trucks. They were inside because it was snowing and cold. And the amount of resources that people pulled together for them, they didn't miss a beat on their snow plowing.
That's great.
Because other cities lent them an entire truck or personnel
that's really
to
awesome.
Help them plow. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think... If you were to go around the country, people, that's not, it's unheard of, honestly. I think it's a cultural thing here in Utah where people lend aid to one another because you got places in the same city that departments don't even talk to one another.
Right.
Where here we do it on a grander scale,
how
quite
refreshing.
Frankly. It's
the golden rule, right?
In fact, we have, you know, one 911 dispatch center other than Salt Lake City, which is good because we need redundancy too. But we have something that we can all be together on in that fashion. But even larger than that, the UCA board that I sit on, the Utah Communications Agency, provides a backbone system, which is basically a utility that's run on a statewide basis for public safety radio and 911 systems throughout the state. And it's actually leading the nation in the way that we're cooperating together, where you have the entire state on one backbone instead of a bunch of cut up multiple different jurisdictional issues that come up. We've been able to do it seamlessly. So we're really fortunate that we live where we do and we have cooperation like we do.
And I want to say, even in the county, I work really close with every emergency manager in the county. I feel like that's my department, right? Even though I work for under Chief Dawson in the fire department, I feel like, because I meet with them every at least twice a month, I do want to say that they're really, really impressed with the way our departments and our divisions here in the city work together. You wouldn't see the two chiefs sit next to each other in some cities. It's great.
Sad. Yeah.
That's great. Sad, but I'm grateful that's not the case here.
Right. Absolutely. So federally declared disasters, I'm going to go through this really, really fast, but it'll kind of give you an idea on you know, where and what disasters are declared the most in the state of Utah. So fire, severe storm, fire, earthquake. You remember the earthquake. Fire, pandemic. Fire, severe storm, fire. So kind of get an idea. And I'm going to go all the way back to when I started. Fire, severe storm. Severe storm, flooding, severe winter storm, fire. So we know what we're planning for. We know where our, you know, most of our events are going to come from, and you know, all hazards, all risk, all hazards. However, we also know what some of our top declarations are. So fire, hurricane. How did this affect us? This happened in New Orleans. How did that affect us?
Because we took
taking people.
That's right. We took what?
We took evacuees here and housed and sheltered, I think, about 700 people.
Right.
From Katrina.
Refugees came to Utah. And what does that mean here in South Jordan?
3/4 of them are still here.
If we open up a shelter in the state of Utah, we know from the historical events that we've had that not many people will show up. Why is that? Because there's so many families and there's so many people willing to help and bring them into their house and, you know, and be that support that we really, I mean, we've opened up a couple shelters when there's been fires in Harriman. I've worked for Salt Lake County Emergency Management and helped them over there at the time. And we opened up a shelter, had one person show up. Why does that scare us here? Because I know that if we have a big earthquake in Salt Lake and there's so many unreinforced masonry buildings and structures, where are those folks going to go? I mean, obviously, we're gonna have issues. We've got liquefaction and other things we're worried about. However, we're also worried about those people. I'm not saying those people. I'm saying families bringing others from that area, bringing them to our city. So what's going to happen? Our utilities, are we going to be able to handle it? Water, sewer, power, everything's going to go up. So, yeah, that'll affect us. And there's some things that we're looking at. So floods, landslides, I'll keep going. Fire, severe storm, fire. Going back to the tornado of 1999. Does that happen very often? No. But
obviously it does.
What's that?
We've had two in South Jordan.
Two in South Jordan. Yeah. Anyway, dam failure. We've taken all these hazards, everything that we know, and we've put them on maps. We know, and we've taken every risk and every hazard and put it on a map, and then rated them on an overall to find out which areas of the city, you know, is going to be the biggest risk and have the biggest area for a hazard or potential problems. So we know that there's inundation. Up along this area, which is
Bingham Creek.
This area here. Do we have a dam in South Jordan?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is Oker Lake. We know there's an inundation area through that area. We've done the same thing with flood zones. We've taken the flood zone, the FEMA firm map, and put it on our maps. Hazardous material exposure. What are these areas that are at risk? basically the main corridors, right, with railroad tracks. But we've done the same thing. We've used maps from USGS or Utah Geological Survey, what they put together. If there was a hazard or an earthquake 7.0 or greater that happens along the Wasatch Front, these areas over on the other side of the freeway, we know that they're going to be destroyed.
Where's our town on that map?
Right through here.
Okay.
The purple lines that you see on there are known mapped faults. So
okay.
That's previous areas where we've had surface fault rupture.
Got it.
But that's not necessarily limiting to where that can happen in the valley.
Okay.
But we know that a lot of houses up in that area, up in the avenues, they're all under reinforced masonry, and they're going to have problems. Mm. A lot of our houses, our infrastructure was built after the 70s where seismic standards were in place. Hopefully, you know, and they're built for life safety. You know, and we'll talk about mitigation factors and what engineering and public works and that has done with mitigation as well. But we know that there is concern, whether it's, you know, buildings coming down or people in, you know, coming into the city for housing. Liquefaction, we talked a little bit about liquefaction. Soils are right. Groundwater's at a good level down by the river. So if there is shaking, liquefaction is going to be an issue. Wildfire, I've updated the map. Originally, we had areas of urban wildland interface. We've actually taken this and overlaid the map that Chief Dawson created for the firework map and the potential hazards we have for wildland all over the city. So that's been helpful. We've taken it and put all of those hazards on one map, and it kind of tells you which areas of the city are the highest and most potential for problems.
So the red would be the highest.
Red would be highest.
So we don't have much work.
Which we might have one or two buildings down here. And then followed by the orange and green, or orange and yellow. And then it just kind of gets better and better.
Is that the old thyroid that you took that from?
Yeah. So, again, I told you that, you know, during either a catastrophic event, a disaster, or even a planned event that we have in South Jordan or in the city, we know that communication is either one, a failure, or two, it's always on the lessons learned or after action report. So what has the city done? And I want to thank the Parks and Rec for what they've come up with. But I don't know if you guys are familiar with Basecamp. Everything we do when it comes to a planned event, we use Basecamp. Basecamp is awesome. And I can't say enough about it because anything that you put down, any messages you put down, campfire, any information, it goes to that group. It always keeps people in the know, keeps you apprised of what's going on. It's all up to date. It's the most up-to-date material. If you were to update the documents and files, it's going to be the latest and greatest. So go to Basecamp. That's where you're going to find. And what we do is we take the Incident Action Plan, or the IAP, and put it on in docs and files. If I make any changes to the IAP, it's automatically updated. So, again, communication is always a failure. So what did the city do here to try to help improve that? So the Incident Action Plan is basically, this is the latest one from Light the Night, 2022. And what it is basically an outline of what we've got going during a planned event. So every planned event that we have, we'll do an Incident Action Plan. And it tells you what's going on. We take the activity or the schedule and the you know, the agenda basically and put it on this IAP. And it helps us, everybody that's working the event, it helps them know what's going on and where we're at as far as that process. If something goes outside of normalcy, where we have either lost kids, there's a protest, there's an explosion, there's evacuation, you know, anything that we do that's outside of that planned event, then we have what's called an EAP. And we put an EAP together for every planned event as well. And that will help things like, you know, what happened in Las Vegas. So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes when it comes to emergency management, when it comes to intelligence, when it comes to you know, trying to provide the right information and have the safest event. But every one of our staff members that uses Basecamp, they all help with the information that goes into these documents. So do I have a comfort level, a really good comfort level here in the city working with the staff that I work with? Absolutely. They do a great job. I said I was going to talk a little bit about mitigation and prevention measures that we use or we do. Seismic standards, this capital improvement projects that a few years ago, Dustin and the facilities group identified gas valves that needed to be installed. Seismic valves is what they're called. They automatically shut off if there's any kind of shaking or shifting. They've been installed on buildings, so we've done CIP projects. I talked a little bit about seismic standards since the 70s where things have improved. There's seismic straps that are put on houses, building codes that have improved. Flooding. The engineering department, I know, does an outstanding job with ensuring that either retention ponds, detention ponds, built a 100-year flood, 100-year storms, upgrading size storm drains. Our public works does an outstanding job of making sure those are clean, not only video cameraing, but cleaning them out with their vac truck. So some of these things, all of these things that are mitigation, I don't know that we realize that it's actually not only, I mean, I'll use another example, buried power lines. Originally, I thought that when I was in public works, I thought buried power lines, we required buried power lines for aesthetics. It looks better, right? But it's also a mitigation measure that, you know, in case there's a severe storm. We didn't have nearly as many power outages this last week as they did in Salt Lake because a lot of our power lines are underground. They're not in the middle of trees. Trees didn't take them out. So these are all mitigation measures as well. Replacement of cast iron, asbestos, cement pipe, water storage tanks. When I was a water manager, we were just barely getting started putting in water tanks, storage tanks, internal training and exercises, citizen programs, going out and doing the community outreach and education. Something that Chief Dawson's really, really big on. Business readiness is something that Salt Lake County helps promote, but we could do a little bit better in business readiness. But having the MOUs in place and mutual aid agreements in place is all mitigation measures. Again, part of communication, we've got succession lists. That we know that if something happens to me, we know who the next guy up is. If something happens to Chief Knight, we know who the next guy is. And if something happens to anybody in this room, we know who the next person up is.
That's the document that you guys adopt by resolution every June that he's referring to that outlines that.
So there's also IPAWS. IPAWS is an integrated public alert and warning system. There's a few different... if you ever hear on the radio or television, an emergency alert, there's an emergency alert. That's what the EAS is. They can also send them out via cell phone or mobile device, text or emails. It's called the wireless emergency alert. And then NOAA also has their weather radios. So all of these things that we not only have the ability to push out, but we work really close with Salt Lake County and the state of Utah on any of these alerts. VEC has an emergency notification system. I know that we're constantly asking people to register and sign up complete a form with their mobile user. We've got social media, internal text messaging, pre-scripted emergency messaging. We've got 4 sat phones. WebEOC, which is a software program that we use, provided by Javari, that helps us communicate with other emergency managers, with the county, with the state. We know what's going on within the valley, and we use that quite a bit. Mutual aid agreements and the WECAN system. I'm going to have Dustin explain the WECAN system a little bit, but these are all forms of communication that may seem like they're redundant, but we know where the failures are when it comes to training and exercise and catastrophic disasters. So we're trying to have those redundancies. What is the WECAN system?
So our main radio system is called the UCAN, the Utah Communications
Authority now.
Yeah. Well, a couple years ago, UCAN boasted that their system would never go down, that it would always be available, and we had an event in the valley that basically took it down. And at that time, we had a police officer and I, and we worked together. We developed our own backup system that allowed us to use our existing 800 megahertz equipment on our own 800 megahertz network that we had developed, and we started calling it the We Can system, because when you can't, we can. And Aaron and his team have managed to keep that system in place, keep it maintained. All of our first responders have those backup things already programmed, so that if we lose that primary system, we don't have to issue any new equipment. They can switch over, and we have a viable, capable 800 megahertz network system, and it's pretty impressive.
Have other cities copied us?
No.
Wow.
It's pretty cool that we have
that.
So we actually had, we've got four conventional repeaters. We have one in Sandy, up on the one of their water tanks. We've got one in our public works building, and we had two out on the Okers. Well, two out on the Okers was costing us quite a bit. So sitting down with Chief Dawson, and he's got really good hookups, not only in emergency management, but in radio communications as well. We sat down and we talked. He said, well, let's get those off Oker Mountain, you know, and just give me the okay and we'll do it. And that's what we did. So again, public safety, public works, and this is, it's called Flatiron up in Sandy. Those are the, I don't know if you can see the towers that are public safety here. This one's actually a backup to a site we just put in. So this is over out at Highland Park. We used Highland Park. We built a room inside of, and we pulled the repeaters off the Oker Mountains, put them in here, took some chain link, put it up, and built a room. And now we've got communications inside that storage facility out at Highland Park. And if you can see, Dustin, a sign in the back says, if you talk communications, UCA can't, we can. So that's one of those things. But what we've done is originally, when I pulled those repeaters off the Oker Mountains, I worked with the company that they were leasing the property. It was costing us $4,800 a year to lease the property to have our repeaters up there, which is how much is that a year? $4,800 a year. I'm sorry, how much is that after 10 years? And we've had them up there for over 10 years. $48,000. So we thought, no, we got to get those off. We can control it. We can maintain it better than they can, and we can build what we want. And so that's what we did.
Nice.
Aaron, I'll just mention, if you don't think disasters happen, I watched a wall of water about 15, 20 feet high that was several miles long come into Rexburg, Idaho. And the only way we were able to, because it took down everything, all of the power, phone lines, there was nothing left. And the way we communicated back then was CB radios.
That's right.
Luckily, we had CB radios in our vehicles, and we were able to clean up the entire town of Rexburg using CBs. That's all we had. No cell phones, no landlines, nothing was left.
And when Puerto Rico was wiped out, it was the same thing. What did they turn to? They turned to ham radio operators. Yeah. And that's the only way they could communicate with the United States. I don't know how much time I have, but I'll go quick. WebEOC, we talked about WebEOC. I just shared as part of our communications throughout the state and county. But it basically gives us a situation report. We know what's going on within the county and within the state. But we'll put in our activity log what we're doing in our city. Any kind of damage assessments, if there's facility status, if we've got this facility down or if something's happened to this facility, we'll put it in WebEOC. And then it's basically telling the story of what's going on in the county. So it's giving everybody the same common operating picture. So I know during the earthquake, I knew what was going on in Magna. I knew what was going on in what West Jordan was working on, what Riverton, you know, how many requests they had. It's basically what this is. But the county just went through and the state went through and updated to a new version. So as soon as we get that version completed, and we're going to train a lot of our staff members to use this as well. So it's another tool in the toolbox. Our emergency operations center is out at Station 64 with our backup at City Hall. Emergency operations center will be the basically the resources for those working in the field. I'm not going to tell Jason Rasmussen's guys what they're supposed to be doing. I'm not going to tell Chief Knight or Chief Dawson what their guys are supposed to be doing. They're the experts in their field. All we're going to do is be their support. If they need something, if they need additional resources, all the emergency operations center is a support for what's going on out there. So what the plan is to take all of these positions and have checklists for. So when we bring somebody into the emergency operations center, we assign you a position and you've got checklists, and that will be for internal. That'll be for staffers. Safe neighborhoods. There's a part of this SEMP has the neighborhood network. Neighborhood network is safe neighborhoods is part of that. So in Salt Lake City, about 5 years ago, they started Safe Neighborhoods. The SAN stands for Schools Aid Families in Emergencies. It went through legislature. They decided, yeah, we're going to use elementary schools as a neighborhood hub in case something happens. We'll be able to use it for transportation, communication, reunification, coordination. Safe Neighborhoods, the tagline was grab your kit and walk to school. Well, we don't want you to grab your kit and walk to school. I don't want you to be in South Jordan. I don't want you to abandon your house. If your house is, you can stay in your house, stay in your house. However, I want you to follow your emergency, your family emergency plan. And then I want you to follow what you're doing in your neighborhood. And then what I want you to do on top of that, and to complement what you already have in place, I want you to take the information to the elementary school. And at the elementary school, we're going to have, in every elementary school, there's what's called a JIT kit, which is a just-in-time kit. And they're already in the schools right now. So if you go to the elementary school, look on the front window, there's a window cling that tells you exactly where the JIT kit is in each of the elementary schools. And all this is going to be used for is to help us get a situational awareness on what's going on in our city. But like I said, we don't want you to abandon your house. We want to know what's going on. I'm going to grab this map really quick. I don't know if you can see this, but it's easier for us to communicate with 9 elementary schools than it is with 86,313 residents. So grab the information, gather what's going on in your neighborhood, bring it to the elementary school. I've got 3 ham radio coordinators assigned to each elementary school for redundancy. They're gonna go to the elementary school and call me call our ham radio operator that's assigned to the EOC and let them know what's going on. Again, it's easier for us to coordinate with a small group than it is a big group. So additional resources. If we're overwhelmed in South Jordan, we use our mutual aid agreements. We can contact the county. We can contact the state. We can contact FEMA. I'm a local FEMA representative, basically, Federal Emergency Management Agency. Volunteer organizations active in disasters, those are the 501c3s that I work with, and I work with them really close, which is Utah VOAD members. Here's all the VOAD members. I know that I can call. If we have a catastrophic event and we need help, we need additional resources, we can call these VOADs, and they'll come in and give us a hand. Whether it's the Church of Scientology, or whether it's the Presbyterian Church, or the LDS Church, or the LDS Charities, they'll come in and give us a hand. So, and they all specialize in different things. So in conclusion, that SIM enables us to work together to prevent, protect against, respond to, recover from, and mitigate the effects of an incident, regardless of cause, size, location, or complexity, in order to reduce the loss of life and property and harm to the environment. It puts us all on the same page, just like those fire hydrants. You know, we need to be working off the same sheet of music, and that's what this does. Basically tells tell us how we're going to operate internally, what we're going to do, and how we're going to operate with others that come in for support and help. So that's it from me.
Got one question.
Question?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, in the not so unlikely event that there is additional property that enters the city of South Jordan, how long is it going to take to update this plan?
When I started, Dustin said to me, he said, take this plan right here, and at some point we need to get it adopted, but it's a fluid document and it's changing constantly. So we're required, we're told that we need to change it every or update it every 5 years. It's been a little while since we've updated it or brought it through council, but that's constantly going to keep changing because of the lessons learned, the catastrophic the events. I mean, even police response, you know, after school shooting, the change the way we respond to Columbine. After Columbine, it completely changed the way police and fire respond to active shooters. And it's the same thing with emergencies. Every time that something goes on, we learn from the after-action report, and we go through and we update it.
So to answer that question, there's not a lot that has to be updated because it's an all-hazards plan and it's scalable. So even if we grow in size, it doesn't change how we do business. It may require us to tweak the hazard analysis because of maybe there might be a new hazard based on topography or something like that. But for the most part, our response plan doesn't really have to change significantly.
I see that coming for some reason.
You're so astute.
So if there's a catastrophic emergency outside of staying out of the way, what's our role?
That's a great question.
Well, that is absolutely one of the best questions. And your role is really before disasters even happen. And by that, I mean it's your role to make sure that we're doing things as a city to be prepared. So when you build a new fire station, when you buy new equipment, when you adopt the budget to have the staff in place, when you adopt policies, when you adopt ordinances for the building standards, that all plays into our emergency management plan. Now, when it actually goes down, make sure you get one. There are some things that we need you to do. Being visible, being around in case we have to change a policy on the fly. Hopefully we've thought far enough ahead that we have the right policies, but we may need to change something. We may need to suspend something. That's why when we do the declaration of emergency, we include in there the ability to suspend the purchasing policy for 72 hours. So you passing that resolution to do that proclamation, those things help to get that done, right? You can also be the face of the city to help us share messages, what we need people to do, what we need them to not do, because they're going to look to you for that information, which Aaron and his team are going to feed to you to be there and be present for that. But a lot of it is going to be before we get there.
And this guide that I just passed out, it's the City Council Guide to Disaster Operations. So that'll tell you exactly what you need to do. Dustin, he actually wrote it quite a few years ago. I was able to update it, and I was hoping somebody asked, so I had the opportunity to pass it out.
Can I do a follow-up question to that, to Don's question? So let's pretend there's a major flood or a major earthquake. Cell phone service goes out. You've got 5 council members and a mayor. You would operate your plan without our thumbs up. It would just go into place. So unless something shifts, you don't need our approval. You just run with what you've got.
And depending on what the incident is, you might be part of a policymaking group that would help determine whether we're going to spend money, resources, financial decision-making. So all of those might be part of that.
In the event that you needed to get in touch with us, there's no cell phone service. What would be the procedure?
These are the kinds of things that Aaron and his team will sit around the table and they'll ask all these what-ifs. Mm-hmm. When I used to ask those what-ifs, and he may have changed this, we talked about having some of our volunteer network that have a four-wheeler, pairing them up with a person with a ham radio and driving out to your house on a four-wheeler, sitting there with you with a ham radio and establishing a communication.
So you've already obviously had that.
Or we may we may plan to go pick you up and bring you back.
Or just let Patrick make all the decisions because he's closer to City Hall.
Well,
on the block here.
It might be that we can't
but
get all six of you, right?
Right.
But
right.
If I can get three of you here,
right.
Then we can hold an emergency meeting. We can still get business done.
Right.
So Aaron and his team may walk through all those contingencies. How do we
so you run out, get three of us, pull us back, and make a decision.
Yeah.
And there's 10 different ways to communicate in this scent as well. And it says, here's the primary... You know, which is cell phones, here's secondary text messaging, here's tertiary, and it just keeps going on and on.
So at some point, would it be smart, maybe you've already done this, to figure out where the ham radios are in our city?
We've done that.
Okay, well, there you go.
Aaron has a whole team. At one point, there was an Ochre Lake Radio Club. I don't think that they're functioning right now, but many of those members of that original club mm-hmm. still team up with Aaron. We keep them in practice by having them come out and work special events with us. So you've
love
seen
it.
Them at the parades, and we've been our announcers. We continually incorporate them into our regular events to keep them practiced, to test our equipment.
I know we did it
build
at the
relationships.
Too, right?
They were a big part of Tour of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron meets with those guys regularly to
we've
talk
got
to
seven
them.
Of them that are volunteers for the city. They actually work for the city, and they've been vetted just like a part-time or a you
they
know part-time
have
trip, but
ID
volunteers.
Cards and access to certain buildings and equipment.
I love it. Is
and
Lance Fomer one of them?
Yeah,
I love
yeah. And
Jeff Klusmeyer.
And Dawson, at some point, I've sat down with him, and we're going to test some of the exercises and training that's in this plan. This document right here will help you quite a bit. But at some point, we're going to come up with a tabletop exercise.
There's a couple things. One is if communication ever does go down, whether you need us or not. I mean. I'd like to have some sort of communication with the council. Just say, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what's going on. We may need you. We don't need you right now. We're good. But just some sort of communication. Otherwise, if I don't get any communication, I'm just gonna come over.
you remember during
yeah.
COVID, I sent you a weekly sit rep
yeah.
to keep
yeah.
you in the loop.
Yeah.
If we have the big event, you're going to see sit reps very similar to that to keep you updated,
good.
Put you on standby, call you in. But, you know, again, I don't want to have you come here and spend hours with nothing to do, right? But I may be feeding you a lot of information and saying, hey, I'm going to need an emergency meeting in 8 hours
yeah.
or 6 hours, you know, plan to be here for that. And if the roads are tore up, here's how I'm going to get you here. But, yeah, we'll communicate that. And
okay.
Aaron has his plans for, you know, hopefully I can get you on your cell phone or your text message or it becomes I send a radio out to your house. You know,
we need to be able to sleep in the
horse.
Store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
we can't,
no.
If
yeah.
we can't rely on these people,
100%.
We're in big, big trouble.
And remember,
right?
We've had a few of these.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And just walked you through COVID. Don't forget McMahonville House.
Mm-hmm.
We had an emergency meeting
mm-hmm.
by like 9:30 that morning where you got an update. We needed your policy, your
yeah.
decision on a few mm-hmm. things. We got all that done throughout the day. There were constant text messages. Communications weren't out then, so we used what we had. But you guys were... update to date throughout the whole day, knowing what they were going to do and stuff, to the point that several of you were on scene at different times, well, kind of on scene.
Yeah, and you guys yeah. probably never saw it, but remember when COVID started on March 17th and we had the earthquake? Aaron actually had the EOC stood up over here in the other room and was managing both disasters at the same time with our team. And it happens. It stands up and it goes.
Good.
That's awesome.
I have a question about the Safe Neighborhood Program. So set up for the 9 various elementaries, how does the communication with the neighborhood actually work? Because I'm thinking my neighborhood, the LDS Church would most likely be the one who would step forward with each of the 8 wards, though, all having their own emergency plan. I doubt any one of them knows to go back to this safe neighborhood thing. How are we actually connecting the program with the residents?
So we want to continue to do that. Have your ward plan, mm-hmm. your stake plan. But we, on top of it, as an extra step, we want you to take what you gather from the LDS Church and then take it over to the school, just so that we know what's going on.
Yeah, but those of us in this room know that. I'm talking about all the other residents. How are we communicating that there's a plan like that in place?
One thing Aaron does is he goes out and meets with neighborhood groups on a regular basis. And so I would encourage your neighborhood, if they have not had Aaron come to a neighborhood event and speak and share that information, that you invite Aaron out to your neighborhood. He's gone out to LDS ward events. He's gone out to neighborhood barbecues. He's gone to HOA meetings. He's hosted neighborhood meetings here for people. The more that he can be out and share that message with people, the better that whole system will work.
And we've shared it in the newsletter and other
things. A couple months ago, my whole neighborhood and all of this area over here, they met with Aaron over here, Public Safety Building. They set a night, sent out flyers to every household. It wasn't part of the church. It was a community-type orientation. And they have members and non-members alike that came to that meeting and got this information.
That's good. Always really good.
And he's always available for all kinds of presentations to the public.
Does the group need to be a certain size, Aaron?
No. Oh, no.
Okay.
Up to 500.
Okay.
Yeah, prior to the church kind of stepping away from the scouts, I was heavily involved in scouting and helping their, get their merit badge. Yeah. And it was awesome. And I'd sit down with groups of two or three or 20 or 50, whatever.
Okay.
Cool. I like the system a lot better than what they had when the Teton Dam failed. We actually, back then, it was called the Civil Defense.
Yeah.
And they were the legislative authority. And when a next door neighbor came over and was yelling and screaming, and I turned off a lawnmower, she said the Teton Dam broke. And I ran in and told my dad, because he and two other guys had to take over the county and proceed from that point forward in all of the cleanup efforts of the entire Madison County. I just telling you, I want these guys to take over South Jordan a lot more than my dad and two college professors with me.
But you knew what to do in emergency.
These guys know what they're doing. My dad and his buddies did not. They did a great job, and I actually worked for them that summer. But I have great confidence in these folks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Aaron.
That was fabulous.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, everyone, for this great discussion. All right. We're going to move on to item E2. We've got about 35 to 40 minutes at the most if we want a bathroom break before the next meeting starts. And we've got three items to discuss. We've got the 1055 Rise Development Analysis next. We're going to turn it over to WCG engineers. Tim Taylor is here with us. And I'm not sure who from our staff actually is going to head that up.
Tim's going to be our main speaker, but I'll just tee it up for him. And
thank you.
As we know, we had that Rise development come in, and we wanted to make sure that we had the right look at the traffic patterns in that area. And so I asked Tim to do some analysis on it just to make sure there was some concern about connecting that to 1055 or what should happen. We heard the public hearing portion. And so with Stephen being connected with it and Brad Clavenall, Tim put together some analysis. He's going to show us his presentation now. But that's what the basis of it for is. As we know, that area is going to continue to grow now. Once the first development starts, it just starts to roll out. And we wanted to make sure, what does the traffic look like in that area if it fully develops? What do we have the right network of streets? And whatever he may present may generate some questions that you have. It's a time for us to discuss it, and we wanted to kind of do that before we got to the next part of this, which is to prove the development and move forward. So,
thanks, Gary.
Yeah.
Hi, Mayor and Council members. Thanks for letting me be here tonight. Aaron, I apologize for walking right in front of your presentation. I apologize to you as well.
I have to speak up into that microphone, Tim, so the mayor can hear you.
Okay.
Right. She's online.
Okay. Will do. So let me just start off. I think you're probably all fairly familiar with the area. I've outlined it here in the yellow and the red so that you can see the area that we've been asked to take a look at. It's made up of what we've designated as four areas. The Rise development portion is right in the middle in the white. And then in the blue is what we're calling area 2. Area 1 up at the top in the yellow, and then Area 3 in these two segments here, kind of the orange color. These are all potentially developable areas. And we were asked to look somewhat conservatively at what type of land uses would go in here, and then what type of traffic would be generated by these. And based on that, develop and make sure that we feel comfortable, that you feel comfortable with the roadway network that would be able to service the traffic from this area. Does that make sense? So in this exhibit, you can see what we've made assumptions. In the yellow area, there is a development that was just, I guess, rezoned or approved for 13 single-family units up here. In this area, which are all existing housing, it's an R18, so one single-family home per 1.8 acres. 1.8 units per acre. And then the rest of that we assumed kind of a multifamily at about 8 units per acre. So that's that area 1. Area 2 is 8 units per acre as well, which turned out to be about 135 units. And then the area 3 were also kind of the R18 designation. And then the Rise development is 142 units. I think that's still correct. Is that right? 142 units or thereabouts for the Rise development. So when we looked at this, we also wanted to point out that in this area, the office complex area, there is a vacant area that could potentially have a building, an office building in there, similar to like one of these type of footprints somewhere in that green area. There is no proposed connection up to 1055 West. All of that traffic would flow down here to Riverfront Parkway and would be easily accommodated by that. So we're not including this green area as a part of what we're looking at for the rest of this, what we're calling the Rise development area. Any questions about the land uses or the areas we're talking about here? Okay, I'll move on then. Okay, this is nitty-gritty stuff, but bear with me. So we know the land use and we know the acreage, and then we have trip generation rates that we say, okay, single family home generates this number of trips during the day and during the peak hours in the morning and the evening. And we did that. We went ahead and ran that based on the number of dwelling units, the type of dwelling units. And then we summarized the daily trips here, the AM peak hour, which is 1 hour between 7 and 9 AM is the AM peak hour. And then in the PM peak hour, 1 hour between 4 and 6 p.m. Those are your typical peak periods during the day. We show what the ins and the outs and the total are for those peak periods. And you can see in here, and my main point is we have about 404 units we would think would be reasonably fit into this area that would generate about 2,800 daily trips. That's throughout the whole day. And then in those peak periods, in the AM peak period, about 175 total, and in the PM peak period, about 225. If you understand the traffic and understand what roadways can handle, that amount of traffic can easily be accommodated by a pretty simple roadway network. So there won't be any problems with any of these scenarios accommodating the traffic that would be generated by this type of density of development in this area. Let me show you that as we move forward. We looked at three options for the area. The first option here is the one that you're currently planning on, which would take 10840 South. It would go towards the west and then bend up to the north to tie into South Jordan Parkway, 104th South, and tie into that existing signal. That is what Rise Development is planned on doing, where they have this swooping road coming through, and eventually it would tie up to 104 South. Right now, the thought is that there would be a connection to 1055 West of some sort. And a traffic impact study was done previously to show what the impacts of that specific amount of traffic would be from the Rise Development. That is our option number one. Area two would be serviced not only by 1055 West, but by these two connections through the Rise development.
Could you go back one slide?
Yes, yes.
Would Area 2 have anything that would dump out towards the Riverfront Parkway on its own, or would it all have to go to 10840?
It would all have to go to 10840.
So there's no way to get it through that parking lot or any...
With the canal there,
the
crossing
canal.
The canal,
okay.
Makes that a challenge.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank
and
you.
The grades also do.
Okay.
Well, but there would also be a connection on 1055.
There could be, yes.
On area 2, just
yeah.
Making
yeah,
sure we're on the same
you.
Page.
We assumed a connection to 1055.
Absolutely.
So there would be 3 into that area 2.
Okay.
Connection. Area 3 would all be serviced on 1055.
But I think Councilwoman Zander's point is there is going to be an access to connect to 10840.
Yes.
From area 2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right here for sure.
Yeah.
And that's been planned for.
Thank you.
So that's option 1. Option 1 has some challenges. When you look at connecting up to this existing traffic signal on South Jordan Parkway, the challenge with that is 10550 South is so close to where that intersection would be that there would need to be some realignment of that. To put Baxter Drive all the way through would require some pretty, I guess, I don't know what you would, you would require some property acquisition in order to do that.
iPhone creative.
Use four-letter words.
And for 10550, 2 options, one shown in the green, the other is shown in the blue. The green would be the cul-de-sac, the existing 10550 South. So if you lived in this area, you would come up to this traffic signal. And then, again, this is the green. And then the area that goes into the AE Urbia building, that would be realigned to come up and tie further to the south into this extension of Baxter. That's one option. Again, these are just broad planning level things. The other would be to just take 10550 South and realign it so that it came straight across and tied in here. Again, pretty impactful to those properties in that area. So that's a constraint associated with option 1. Option 2 would be basically the same thing, except the Baxter Drive connection or the 10840 would just T or end at 10550. So you could still access the traffic signal up on South Jordan Parkway. You could come down 10550, or you could go over and down in that regard as well. But you would still maintain that rise development road that is currently being planned. Any questions on that one? Okay, option 3. Oh, let me back up. Sorry. That road where it tees in could vary. So you could have it tee in further this way or further this way. Based on the way that this is being developed, there could be the potential to realign that so that it came up between two properties and have a lower impact to the properties in that area. Okay. Option 3 is the one that would take the most traffic down 10550 West, at least the northern half of it. So it would use this road coming up. It would bend a little bit more than it does now, and then it would tie into and have a direct connection into 10550 West, kind of just south of the cemetery. Then the road that went all the way further to the south would actually tee in on that little curve so that you would have very little traffic coming this way, but there would be more traffic up here than there currently is now. Those are the 3 options. There's a lot of different tweaks that you could do in between, but these are the ones that represent, I guess, the coalescence of all the smaller options. These are the 3. Then what we did is we took all the traffic that we generated. Again, this is back to the figure we showed you earlier. And we assigned it to all these 3 different options so that you can look at the traffic coming in and out for each option and compare them. So let me let you get your bearings on this. Those dashed red lines represent the roadway option. And then these arrows represent the 2 numbers. The one in parentheses is the PM peak hour number. And the one in front of that without parentheses is the AM peak hour number. That's the number of cars, if you were standing next to the road, that you would count while sitting there for an hour during those peak periods. And so looking at option 1, the one that's currently planned, you can see that most of your traffic is geared towards going up to the signal at Baxter. But if you look at those numbers, 160, that is really not a lot of traffic to need to be accommodated for this whole area. That could be easily accommodated by a local road or something between a local and a collector road. The impact coming out to 10555 West is still minimal. Right now, in the peak periods, there's about 30 cars that come south of 10550 South. There's about 30 cars in the AM and 30 cars in the PM is all. So you, and this does not include those. This is extra that would be added on. Again, if you're standing there for, you know, a 60-second period, you would likely see about 60 cars come by. One a minute is what you'd be looking at if you had a volume of 60. So these impacts are, in a straight traffic standpoint, can easily be accommodated by that roadway network. It is tough for residents, and I completely understand after doing this for 30 years that if you have 5 cars and you go to 20 cars, you've just increased it by 400%, and that's a disaster. But from a traffic standpoint, it's not a huge change in terms of safety or operations.
Except for that road, Baxter doesn't exist. So if Rise Development were to develop next month, all of the 160 cars, 130 cars, would not be going that way because it doesn't exist. They would be exiting other ways. Have you assessed, would they go east or would they go west?
So let me clarify. This represents traffic from the entire area, not just the Rise Development.
Okay.
So the Rise Development's traffic study, and we have those traffic volumes, results in only like 13, 14 new cars on
1055
West.
A day.
Yeah.
Or just in the morning?
Just during those peak hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
During those peak hours.
Thank you.
This represents everything.
Got it. Thank you.
I'm gonna go back and forth. So this is the option that tees into 10550 South, but doesn't connect to the Baxter signal. You can see that the volumes on this road, that's what they were if there's a connection. That's what it is if they don't have the connection. So it does have more traffic on 1055 West. You can see how it went up there to 90 in the PM from about 40. But this increased a bit as well. So that connection is pretty significant that goes up to the Baxter traffic signal. But again, from a pure traffic standpoint, you could easily accommodate this roadway network as well and service all of that development in that area. Lastly is this one. And again, I told you this was the most impactful to the northern part of 1055 West. You can see these volumes are upwards of 140, 120. So that's a car every 30 seconds. I think, am I doing the math right? If you're standing there in one direction, you'd count a car about every 30 seconds, which if you've ever gotten done that, that's a long time. It seems like you're sitting out there for a long time if you see a car for 30 seconds. But it's more than they're counting right now, right? And we recognize that. And this area could still have connections to 10550. They would just not be, they would not likely be a major connection. Again, this one will accommodate those traffic volumes in that area just as well. Questions on any of the traffic for these three options? How we assign them?
So on 1055 West, there's got to be an assumption there that the current road would have to be expanded in order to accommodate that level of traffic.
I think it accommodates the same width we talked about before, which was that
the standard
residential road standard.
Just a local road residential standard.
Which is wider than what they have now.
Yeah,
it is.
Okay. Especially towards
the
southern. Making
sure I'm on the same page. So.
Okay. We move on here a little bit. These are the existing traffic volumes in the morning and the evening at 1055 South and 1055 West. So again, you can see there isn't a lot of traffic right now at that intersection. And then at the roundabout down here on Riverfront Parkway, the traffic volume's there as well. As we've ran all three of these scenarios, these intersections can easily accommodate the traffic volumes from this area without degrading, you know, the amount of time you're sitting at the stop sign or that. You've heard the term level of service before. It's a level of service in every condition, whether it's always stopped at this intersection or it's two-way stopped, it's still a level of service A, so you can accommodate that well. That's basically what I was saying here. We tested this with the existing traffic. We tested it with the Rise development traffic, which is here. Sorry, you can't see the titles because it's covered up by the top. And then this one looked at option three, where you have the most traffic coming up 1050 West. And all of those had a level of service A. So they can all accommodate the traffic that would be generated in that area. And I think that's it. Questions? You have questions?
Yes. I have some questions, but this might be directed more towards staff. I mean, how would the funding, if we went to option one or two of that road, you know, to connect either to Bax or to 104th, I mean, how would that be funded? Are the developers funding it? Are we funding it?
You know, I think it's timing, and then obviously some of it's going to be developer funded. They're building their roads in Rise, and the next section up, Area 1, that's going to have to be developed and the road grid put in as well when that development comes forward. So yeah. Portions of it could be done by the development, but the connection, if it were to go all the way through and there needed to be other acquisitions of property to make that accommodate that, that would probably be on the city.
Generally what you'll see is there will be a step road to like that yellow area if the city can wait, and as that develops, then the new development will have to connect. That's the ordinance, Council Member Marler, and that council decade and a half ago put in, would force it to connect through, and so they'd have to plan their connection together if we stubbed it. If you needed it more immediately, then you'd have to go through the combination and pay for it.
But if we waited until it developed, then possibly we might not have to acquire
quite as much,
and we could just allow the developers develop that, so we'd say, hey, we know in the long run this is what we may need. We'll stub it for now. Developers, when this develops out, you're going to have to be able to find a way to get a road through there.
Just like the Rise development has to pay for its roads to handle its impact, that this whatever future development would have to do that same thing. We're seeing the same thing. If you think along where the Whedon's property is, that we've talked about potentially putting a road there along their south edge. You know, that's been stubbed for, at least 15, 20 years, Brad? Our temporary storm drain easement.
Longer than I was.
And if it develops, then the developer will have to put in their portion of that road, and if it doesn't, then we won't really want it, and we'll have to commit and pay for it.
Gotcha.
I think the good thing is, from what Tim's analysis shows, is that even if this built out at 8 units per acre in the likely areas that it could, the roads network can accommodate it based on it. And I think that we should always consider, like we have in most places, that we always look at public safety access points. Where do they come in and where can they go? The one interesting part about the Rise development is that 10840 South Street goes over a canal. If it were the only road into there for 142 units without an access out to the back, I'm not sure that would be a great idea. I think by having an access to 1055 certainly helps us both from that perspective. If there were some kind of a failure of that bridge, or it got washed out, or, you know, who knows what could happen that way, that there's an actually a way of getting people out. Because who knows how long either the blue area or the yellow area is going to develop. We know the orange areas are probably going to develop soon, but they're a lot less impactful because the densities are a bit lower on those that are coming in. But I do
think that we need to make sure we have access points for our public safety and people to get in and out of there, as well as emergency.
Jerry, I have a question then. I don't know if it's geared to you or Brad Clavino, but so if yellow, if Area 1 does develop, their obligation is to take that road that Rise Development is contemplating all the way through to the north, but they would end at 10550 south, because that's where they would connect their development, right? Yeah. And that's all their obligation would be. And I think that's part of the answer to Patrick's question, is they go to that point and then it's up to the city to do something else because of traffic.
Yeah, and that's why I said kind of depend, because it depends on, do we really want the Baxter Drive connection or not? And depending on how Area 1 developed out and what properties are left untaken to get that connection there, you could see how complicated that was up there. And there's a lot of properties that would have to be actually used to make that connection work. Now, if it just tees into 10550 south, that's a lot less problematic.
Yeah.
And not as many properties have to be taken out. But Tim's already shown us that if that's what we do, when we don't go to the expense of having Baxter at a full intersection at 106, it suggests that the intersection there still maintains itself at a level A at the intersection right there at 10550 and 1055 West.
I think it'll be a little awkward to have two accesses on Southford and Parkway so close together. I think if we just, you know, tie it in and then just have the one intersection, I think that would...
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. Yeah. We did... I know Brad and I worked with Region 2. This has been what?
12 years ago.
Quite a number of years ago. We asked specifically if Baxter could be a four-way intersection, and they approved it. So I think UDOT would accept it.
Would they?
I mean, who knows? That's been a long time ago. There's nothing in writing. A lot of people have changed and moved on. But at least at the time we looked at it, they were willing to allow it. Now, whether or not we really need it, I'm looking at his numbers and the science behind it. I'm saying, I don't know if we need that intersection there.
You know, there is the opportunity for some good phasing of improvements where you could take the road all the way up to here on the alignment where it connected in.
Yeah.
And let it step there at 10550 for some time. I think one of the benefits that I forgot to mention is that when you have a connection at Baxter and it comes down into this office development area, it does relieve some pressure on this intersection, which would be a benefit. People who come down and make a right turn or who go out and make a left turn and go to the west would be able to come through the roundabout and travel up to Baxter and do that same thing. And those numbers that I showed you accounted for that reorienting of those trips through that area as well, which would be a benefit to the overall network area. Again, the numbers are still low, right? So it's not a huge benefit. It's not going to solve a lot of problems, but it would be a benefit.
But it increases our connectivity.
Yeah,
by connecting
exactly.
to Baxter.
Exactly,
so if we're looking
right.
for additional connectivity, that kind of helps
yep.
with that.
Exactly, yeah.
But if that is the decision, or that's what we recommend, then we need to put that on the long-term plan, transportation
yeah.
plan, so that people are aware that, hey, guess what? This is coming. And don't build a three-story mansion right here, because there may be a problem in the next few years.
I don't think we have it in our current master plan, do we, Brad?
No, I don't believe so.
I just think...
So it's something that, you know, Rise Development is at least starting to prick our minds to go like, oh, how are we going to develop this out at the end? And, you know, I know it's knocking on our door, but we need to probably think a little bit about that. It doesn't really impact him right now, but for us long term it does, and we need to probably figure out how we want to do that.
We're budgeting for next fiscal year to update our transportation master plan, so we'll just dovetail right into that.
Brad, would it be impact fee eligible?
Yes, I believe so.
So that would be helpful.
Yeah, it would be. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Hopefully that's helpful for you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. good discussion and good comments. Appreciate some good insights there from the council as well. Thank you. Okay, next we're going to turn it to our Deputy City Manager, Mr. Dustin Lewis, to talk about boards and committee assignments. We do this every January. He's just going to go over it real quick and see what you think. So, Dustin, take it away.
Thanks, Mayor. This is just a general housekeeping item that we try to take care of at the first meeting of the council each year. And it's just a touch base with you to see how you feel about all of the board and committee assignments that you guys are assigned to, and if you want to make any changes or if you're happy with the way things are. If you're happy with the way things are, you can all give me a thumbs up and we'll just proceed into 2023. If you want me to review them real quick, I can tell you who's on what boards. If you want to have any discussion about any of them, we can do that. Otherwise, it's just some general housekeeping. You want me just to tell you which boards you guys currently sit on?
I think I remember.
Good.
It seems to me like we kind of have a pretty stable council that we've had some consistency.
You've got a really good.
So we don't have a whole lot of, we don't have new council members coming in where we need to make any changes. Unless there's
we
any.
We just made one with you on the sewer board. Other than that, unless you guys.
I'm good. To just continue.
You're good.
Or I'm fine with continuing.
Everybody else looks good.
Yeah. I'm good for another year.
Are you good for the mosquitoes still?
Yeah.
Okay, if you guys are good, did you want me to get
the others, Brian? Good there.
We have one that is a bit unique.
Yeah.
And given that it ties with our legislative stuff, I was just going to have Ryan kind of briefly touch on it just so that you're aware of it.
Well, you guys know for the League of Cities in Town, we have three appointments, essentially, three voting members. But we actually, because the mayor's been serving on the executive board, have a fourth. Her term on the executive board ends this next year as she's the outgoing past president. So next year, this time, we'll go back to three. And so whether you guys want to address that now, from the standpoint of your time, or start looking toward that, just be aware that next year we're going to have to make some changes.
Did you say LPC?
Yeah. Legislative
okay, so
policy.
Currently, there's the mayor, there's Jason, there's Don, and I.
Yes.
Correct.
And you're saying in January, right now, we still get those four.
Yeah,
right,
we'll have those four for the next year, but then we won't. And so one question is start thinking about how we're going to do that. I would propose that we keep the mayor on that as a voting member since she's so tied to the league, and not to push any of you out of your spots. 100%. But, and I know we have an election coming up before then, depending on who decides to run and stuff that we may have to revisit a lot. Also, one thing I would ask for is if you would allow one of staff, either city manager or myself, as we're almost always there, to vote in if you're not there. Sometimes we lose one of our votes if one of you three appointed cannot go.
So I am really having a hard time with my business schedule being at those LPC meetings.
Well, especially now they're going to go every week coming up here in 2 weeks.
Monday is my busiest day in my office. And I just had another meeting with my team and employees that I have to be in on Mondays. So I'm not going to have hurt feelings if you want to replace me or if it needs to be a week by week, I can't be there.
Do you want to just give staff the ability to vote in that place?
This year?
Yeah, we can do that.
Gary's going to be at all.
I'm going to be there.
If that's okay, I mean, if that's okay with everybody.
Do you guys feel okay?
I'm
about
really
that?
Struggling
let's,
being there.
Let's authorize staff. I want to talk more about who, but let's just have it authorize staff. And if you come, we can make arrangements.
That's great with me. If that, Mayor, are you okay with that?
I'm fine with whatever works out best to make sure that we get our four votes, right? Because it really is unique to get four. And while we have the opportunity to have as much engagement and as much input and also, you know, just as much awareness, it does take time. LPC takes time. The meetings are kind of long. They're on Mondays. And they are going to be every week now for the whole, you know, legislative session. They are busy. So I understand that. We do have staff that's there every time unless we've got Patrick or Brad, if either one of you want to take one of the seats on LPC, if Tamara can't do it, you're welcome to. It's just a chunk of time on Mondays. What are your thoughts?
I'm not available to do this particular responsibility. I mean, Gary's offered it. I'm okay with Gary taking it unless Brad is interested in it.
I just think if somebody else.
It's awesome, but I have mosquito board meeting on Monday, but my real estate business is so demanding on a Monday. I just, every time I see LPC, I'm like, oh my gosh, and I can't consistently navigate it. I have to run my business. So I think I better opt out and have the consistency of Gary. If I can attend, am I still able to listen in?
Anyone can attend.
Okay, so let's do that. So you do the vote, Gary.
Or a staff member in general, is that a better wording?
Unless you want the vote.
So I just think if Councilmember McGuire or somebody wants to...
He's on it.
Okay, so who else?
So Jason and Don are
Jason
on it.
Don.
And I'm on it.
Okay, so you know my schedule is like, it's the same as yours, Tamara.
The nice thing about making staff is next year this time the mayor's up in that place and we don't have to...
Yeah, I just say it makes more sense for someone
to... And the mayor, Don, and Jason, sorry, and the council members who attend are all on the same election schedule, so we won't have to revisit it unless they want to for another 2 years.
Okay. Well, when I replace myself in my office, I would love to have more.
I think it'd be good to have Gary do it. That's what I think.
Okay, so
we can make that change to a staff member, and it'll most likely, we'll have some conversation. It'll most likely be good.
Okay, I think that's probably best for the consistency. And then I would love to still have the invite to listen in when I can. It's very informative. I just feel so bad that I can't.
And if you guys are on and you're like, hey, I have an opinion on this and want to go this direction, text us and reach out. Yeah. I mean,
okay.
You don't have staff's going to follow your lead.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and then we'll get you the LPC schedule, and we'll just notice as a potential meeting.
Because we have three attending, whether you're electronic or not, we need to notice it as a potential quorum.
Okay. That's a little fast.
Okay, that was all I had. I just wanted to make sure we were good. I'm going to put a big okay on this, give it back to Anna, and we'll go forward for 2023. Thank you.
Thank you to everyone for the service that you give on all these extra committees. These are things that I don't think that a lot of residents realize go into serving as part of the city council. There's a lot of extra committees and time, and there are folks who might not realize that it's more than just showing up at events and coming on Tuesday nights. There's so much more to it, and you all put in a lot of time in addition to the rest of your lives and your work and your families. Thank you. Right before this meeting, I looked over the list of who all is serving where, and I thought everyone is doing so much. South Jordan is represented more than we ever have been right now. This group, this six elected officials, are serving on more boards and committees than South Jordan's ever had, as far as I know, as far as I've been told. I'm pretty sure that's the case, because there are more that even exist than there have been. But we are kind of everywhere, and it's so good for our city. So thank you all very much for the time that you put in and for all that you do. It matters to the residents who live here in very immediate local ways and in broader ways, in all sorts of ways. So thank you. Okay, legislative preparation. We do not have much time for this, but I also think we have a little bit of time. So I think we'll be okay if we talk about this a little more next time as well. But we'll turn it over to our city attorney, Mr. Ryan Luce, to highlight a couple of things with legislative preparation and gear up for the session. And then this is something we will continue to talk about at length, almost ad nauseum, for the next several months. Mr. Luce.
So what I'm going to do is I'd actually made notes of kind of a list by categories. You can't see that, but it's all here. I'll send this to you right now. Overall, we want to make sure there's a lot of different issues that come up, like should they ban the city's ability to stop plastic bags for grocery sites. Instead of trying to bring everything to you, there's a few overall principles, and I think we know what those are. One, local control is always best for those things which you're elected to do. Land use, the local services like water and things like that. And that you as a council, as I've heard developers and others say, sometimes the mayor and councils want cover, and so they really want the legislature to step in. I don't believe that's our council. Am I on the same page as you guys? For the things you're elected to do, you're happy to do it. You'll take the heat. I've seen several of you, even during election season, you know, do what you think is right for your electorate, even though some of them are upset with you, you know, because you will act. I mean, you know what you're elected for, and you'll take the heat or you'll take the accolades, however they come down, right? So with that principle, the second principle I know that every year we talk about that you as a council dislike is unfunded mandates. When we're required to do things and all of a sudden they cost us more and more money. And those are the two kind of guiding principles we have when it comes to legislative policy issues coming from the legislature as they come through, whether to be sign regulations or the plastic sacks in grocery stores or whatever they may be, to the bigger issues of land use and how all that works. Am I on the same page as you? Is there any other big ticket overarching theme that you guys are concerned about? Okay. If there are, reply to the email, let me know. Happy to, you know, what I want to do is make sure I'm delivering your message as we're up there. And then on the...
I just made a comment. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't mind. I mean, there's so many things going on. But if we had a list of whatever the number is, maybe it's five or three, whatever it is, here are the most five important things mm-hmm. that staff has analyzed that are the most impactful to the city. And we want to bring special attention to these things. But sometimes we get all these things, it can get a little overwhelming, but just say, hey, I really want your attention on these things.
Yeah. We can do that through a weekly update
yeah.
if you want, or an every couple of days update, depending on how fast things are moving. When there are priority things that we need you to reach out on, we'll continue to do what we have done, and you'll just get a blanket text and say, hey, contact Representative Pulsifer or Tusher or which Senator Fillmore. That seems to have worked in the past. I know Councilmember Shelton and Representative Tusher have developed a great relationship on certain issues where sometimes we disagree with our representative. They need to hear from you and those you represent. Because they represent some South Jordan residents and some West Jordan or other cities too. And so they're looking at a different electorate of representation than possibly you are. On the housing front, we've been pushing... this concept of entitled units versus built units.
Yes.
And that's one we want to carry over throughout the session because you keep hearing cities aren't letting them build enough units. Well, when you have over 100,000 units entitled, meaning they can come in, pull a permit, and build them, what more can cities do than approve it to be built? We can't change things beyond that too much. There's a lot of homelessness issues that are still...
Does that argument seem to be carrying any weight?
It started off really good. I know the governor's office, it resonates with them. I'm looking at the mayor because she's been in the same meetings. And you're starting to hear, yeah, but entitled doesn't increase the housing stock. And so now get your turnaround times faster and other things. That's what you hear is that's not just entitled it. Let us build faster with less regulation, less fees. All that will bring down, increase the number of houses. Yeah. I see a certain
what they want.
Planning director shaking his head no there. But that's their concept is now that you've got them entitled and we're over on the administrative side, get rid of all the administrative regulation and we can go faster. Whereas what we're seeing, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brad, Stephen, is they're not pulling permits right now because of the market.
No, their profit margins down.
And so, as if they don't have the if the supply and the demand isn't in the ratio the development wants to keep their margins, you're going to see them create a supply demand issue.
Even during the peak, certain builders have multiple developments that they could have been developing at the same time, but they don't have the capacity. So this idea that they have an unlimited amount of capacity, even when the market's good, that's not a reality either.
Yeah. So let me run through this. I'm getting bogged down, and I'm going to run through a few more things real quick. Short-term rentals are on there. Homelessness issues are on our list. On the economic development front, we're going to be watching changes to the HDRZ. We got our application in, so it shouldn't affect us, but we want to make sure we know what's going on with it, whether it's procedural or substantive changes. Sales tax, we're not hearing as many rumblings as in the past that they want to mess with local sales tax, but you never know when it's going to come up. We have something that's been coming through the last few weeks is on 462, Director Schaefer-Meyer's favorite bill from last year, that has to do with the housing and the plan we have to submit. They're adding an appeal body, so we're discussing the makeup of appeal body because many cities that were told they were out of compliance, we frankly just, not all the cities agree with that analysis. So they're adding that. there's a few people that are, well, mainly Senator McKay is addressing local districts, taxing authority, like the Jordan Valley Water Conservancy District's ability to impose a tax versus pass it all in through their rate. If his bill went through, they wouldn't be able to tax anymore and there'd be rate increases. And also, constitutional amendment make the 45% residential tax discount part of the Utah Constitution. In land use, we're talking subdivisions, annexation, development standards, moratoriums, and any of this stuff on the list, feel free to call me. I'll walk you through what's going on. Public safety, there's a retirement bill out there that would cost the city around $300,000 a year, Gary, that we're working through. There's the issue of the county. Pardon?
It's there every year.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a year.
One more piece.
Every year, it's there.
And there's the county.
And it will never help us recruit more officers.
No. Not everybody believes that. There's the county UPD funding issue that Representative Tusher is taking on. And then the UHP pay issues, and that's just a short list in a few minutes that we put together of top issues that we're following and tracking and working through. Happy to send this to you. Any other question or anything, contact me, and we'll just keep working through the session. What I'm hearing, though, is you prefer each week a short list of the most priority things, not the long list of everything we're tracking. Is that good for all of you?
Just, yeah. Some, if it's impactful to the city,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
Gotcha.
That'd be great. Like an executive summary kind of thing.
And I left you with 2 minutes for change rooms.
For a quick break. Thank you very much. We'll have a Unified Economic Opportunities Commission meeting on the 11th. That was supposed to be a big one the end of November, and it ended up being canceled. So I think January 11th is going to be very big. We're going to have a lot more updates about some of the things that we put on that legislative update list just now. We're going to have a lot more about it. So when we meet on the 17th, we'll have quite a bit to discuss. As we go into the start of the session, we'll know a lot more. So thank you. Thank you for that, Ryan. I'm going to see, does anyone have any additional questions or comments? And if not, can I get a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I'll second that, Mayor.
Thank you. We have a motion by Mr. Sheltman, a second by Mrs. Zander. All in favor, please say aye.
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 All right, we are adjourned.